therapy. So they went to his insurer, which is United Healthcare, by way of Medicaid, and they asked to increase the number of hours of coverage of that he is in therapy. But they were denied. And essentially what the company said was that Benji had been in this specific therapy for too long, and they did not believe that he was going to make enough progress to essentially be able to leave this therapy. You know, experts, we showed the denial to many experts and advocates who said this was outrageous, that, you know, this type of therapy can be used for the maintenance of, you know, or prevention of deterioration, or just to help kids maintain the progress that they've already had. And so Sherelle Menard now has to go to an official administrative law review in order to try to get this denial overturned. She's doing that next month in January.
And how might United Healthcare's strategy be violating a federal law?
Yeah, so most people don't realize this, but there's actually a federal law that protects mental and behavioral health benefits. It's called the Mental Health Parity Act. It was passed in 2008. And essentially what it means is that insurance companies cannot limit your access to mental health care. They essentially have to provide similar access to physical health care as they do for mental health care. And so if this company is using similar strategies to limit physical health care, perhaps it's kosher. But, you know, the experts and the advocates that we've spoken to have said that this strategy is legally questionable. On top of that, it appears that the company is actually targeting Medicaid plans, so the most vulnerable and the poorest families amongst us, with this strategy. And so this strategy may actually, according to the advocates we've spoken with, it might violate Medicaid laws as well, which require prompt access to medically necessary care for children.
And when you say that they are targeting Medicaid plans, are they managing Medicaid plans like they do with Medicare Advantage?
That's correct. United actually manages Medicaid plans in 24 states and for about 6 million people, including 10,000 children with autism spectrum disorder. And so how these Medicaid managed care plans tend or typically operate is that the company receives a specific fixed amount of money for a patient, regardless of how many services they use or the intensity of those services. And if there's money left over, the company, which are typically these private insurers, are allowed to keep what's left over. You know, federal investigators as well as experts have said that there might be an incentive that's put in place that they might try to deny care in order to pocket the additional sum. So there have been questions about whether this is the most appropriate setup, particularly for Medicaid plans or any other type of public funding for healthcare.
Annie, we only have a minute, but you write about United's algorithm program saying, quote, called ALERT. The algorithmic system was created years earlier to identify patients at risk of suicide or substance abuse. The company redeployed it to identify therapy overuse. Can you elaborate on this as we wrap up?
Yeah, so we spoke with hundreds of providers, as I mentioned, and many of them told us about this mystery. They were getting flagged by the insurance company for these aggressive reviews where they would be questioned about the medical necessity of their therapy for their patients, and potentially that therapy could be cut off. What we found out was actually the company had been investigated in three different states and by the Department of Labor for these practices, and they were told that it was illegal and they had to stop it in these jurisdictions. However, the way that our regulation of health insurance works in this country is that it really depends on the jurisdiction in which these actions take place. So even though United Healthcare was told that it was doing something illegal in three different states, it could actually continue to operate with this strategy in other states unless those states took the enforcement. And so what we found is that the company, in effect, rebranded this system, and they're using similar practices around the country to essentially question and potentially cut off care.
Annie Waldman, there's so much to cover here. We're going to link to your reports. Annie's speaking to us from New Orleans in Louisiana. She's a reporter at ProPublica covering healthcare. We'll link to your articles. United Health is strategically limiting access to critical treatment for kids with autism, as well as how United Health's playbook for limiting mental health coverage puts countless Americans' treatment at risk. That does it for our show. Happy birthday, Renee Feltz. I'm Amy Goodman, sitting right next to Juan Gonzalez here in New York.
90.7 KPFK, Los Angeles.
Letters and Politics on today's show.
So this band
of Ned Ludd's army become the Luddites, and they are not at the time mocked or scorned for being backwards looking, as the word might indicate today. They were fierce folk heroes as they go about this campaign, where somebody will send a threatening letter to a factory owner and say, if you don't take down your machines, you'll get a visit from Ned Ludd's army. And if they don't take them down, sure enough, under the cover of night, they will get a visit from men who are organized kind of like an army regiment or a platoon might be organized. They'll hold up the overseer at gunpoint, and they march into the factory with giant hammers, and they smash the offending machines.
A conversation on the Luddites. Our guest is Brian Merchant. He is the author of the book, Blood in the Machine, The Origins of the Rebellion Against Big Tech. That's next on Letters and Politics. But first, the news.
I'm Max Pringle with these headlines. Hundreds are feared dead after a cyclone struck the French overseas territory of Mayotte. France is rushing aid to the Indian Ocean territory. Karen Chamas reports.
The death toll in the French territory of Mayotte from Cyclone Chido is several hundred and may run into the thousands. That's according to the island's top government official, Mayotte prefect François-Xavier Bieuville, who spoke with a local broadcaster on Sunday. Bieuville said it was extremely difficult to get an exact number right now after the Indian Ocean islands were pummeled by the intense tropical cyclone on Saturday, causing widespread destruction. Footage obtained by the Associated Press showed policemen and residents sheltering from the cyclone and corrugated iron roofs on the streets. French Civil Protection Agency footage showed rescue services and armed forces cleaning up debris and trees strewn across the streets. Officials confirmed at least 11 deaths earlier Sunday, but said that was expected to increase significantly. I'm Karen Chamas.
South Korea's Constitutional Court began its first meeting today in the impeachment case to determine whether to formally unseat or reinstate former President Yoon Suk-yeol over his martial law declaration earlier this month. More from Laura Westbrook.
The Constitutional Court has up to 6 months to decide whether to uphold the impeachment. Fresh elections must be held within 2 months if Yoon is impeached. The Prime Minister Han Duck-soo is serving as interim leader in Yoon's stead. There is also another investigation into Yoon and his inner circle over potential charges of insurrection over the short-lived martial law. Laura Westbrook, Hong Kong.
Former Syrian dictator Bashar Assad has issued his first statement since being toppled from office last week. He says he didn't intend to leave the country. Karen Chamas has more.
Ousted Syrian President Bashar al-Assad said he had no plans to leave the country after the fall of Damascus a week ago, but the Russian military evacuated him after their base in western Syria came under attack. The comments are the first by al-Assad since he was overthrown by insurgent groups. He said in a statement on his Facebook page that he left Damascus on the morning of the 8th of December, hours after insurgents stormed the capital. He said he left in coordination with Russian allies to the Russian base in the coastal province of Latakia, where he planned to keep fighting, but he was evacuated to Moscow after the base came under a drone attack. I'm Karen Chamas.
President Biden will sign a proclamation today establishing a national monument to honor Depression-era Labor Secretary Frances Perkins. Perkins became the first woman to serve in a presidential cabinet when Franklin Roosevelt tapped her to be a point person in his New Deal program. Jennifer King reports.
Today, President Biden is signing a proclamation establishing a new national monument in Newcastle, Maine, the family homestead and burial place of Frances Perkins. As a labor secretary under Franklin Roosevelt, she was the nation's first female cabinet member and a driving force behind the New Deal. Perkins was a suffragette with a master's degree from Columbia University who witnessed the 1911 Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire. She earned respect working on fire safety, labor, and industrial policy issues in New York with Theodore Roosevelt and Governor Al Smith. As labor secretary for 12 years under FDR, she's credited, among other things, with helping establish Social Security, New Deal jobs programs, and the National Labor Relations Act that established workers' rights. The Labor Department building on the National Mall in Washington, D.C. bears her name. I'm Jennifer King.
The Postal Workers Union is pushing back against a proposed change to the Postal Service that they say will slow delivery for rural customers during the busy holiday season and beyond. Isabel Charlet reports.
Among other things, the proposal aims to cancel afternoon deliveries and pickups for areas that are more than 50 miles from a regional hub. Postmaster General Louis DeJoy says elimination of night pickups could save the post office more than $3 billion a year. Daniel Cortez with the Oregon Postal Workers Union says reducing services does not make sense financially.
To think that eliminating services, reducing standards, basically providing the American people with less reliable service is somehow going to make money. It's nonsense.
This is the most recent in a series of changes included in DeJoy's 10-year Delivering for America plan. The union says DeJoy, who was appointed under President Donald Trump, has already raised prices for stamps while closing post offices across the country, especially in rural communities. I'm Isabel Charlet.
And those are the headlines. I'm Max Pringle.
Good day and welcome to Letters and Politics. I'm Mitch Jezerich. I've always been fascinated by the meaning of words, and especially the history behind them. Frequently, there is a much deeper story within words themselves, and we actually realize a story that is sometimes completely lost in the modern-day use of a word. My favorite and perhaps most telling example of this is the word Luddite. Today, we use the word as a pejorative for someone who is scared of technology or is uncomfortable or just not good with technology. In fairness, sometimes we also use it playfully, but it's never necessarily a positive thing. But what is lost in our everyday use of the word is its very deep and consequential history. The Luddites were workers and artisans in the early 19th century who rebelled against factory owners who used machines to increase their own profits at the expense of the workers. It was a movement that became quite popular in its day, and a movement that was brutally put down, making it even more peculiar that the meaning of the word has almost become lost in our modern-day usage of it. Today we're going to be in conversation about this history. My guest is Brian Merchant. Brian Merchant is a veteran technology columnist and writer and journalist, and he is the author of the book Blood in the Machine, The Origins of the Rebellion Against Big Tech. Brian Merchant, it's my good pleasure to welcome you to this program.
Oh, thanks so much for having me. Thrilled to be here.
This story about the Luddites, it's in the early 19th century, in other words, early 1800s, sort of beginning around 1811, 1812. We'll get more specific into years in a moment, but this is firmly the time of what we consider to be in the Industrial Revolution. What is happening in the world with machines in the early 1800s?
Yeah, in the early 1800s, you know, the biggest thing that's happening with machines is, you know, there have been some advancements, and across the 18th century and the preceding decades, there have been advancements in the ability for machines to produce large quantities of product or to do tasks more efficiently. But more importantly, and this is what often gets overlooked, is the machines are being organized into factory-like settings, right? They're being set up so that the labor can be divided and operated under an overseer or a factory boss or an owner. So you have changes to the machinery itself, that is, it's getting more productive, and then you have particular sort of subset or class, emerging class of person who is seeking to sort of capture those productivity gains for himself or for, you know, a relatively small group of people. Whereas previously, a lot of these machines had been used in various capacities, but under the control of a single master weaver or in a small shop that, you know, people were working on equal footing. So yeah, right about that time, you have this divergence both in the mode of economic production, and you have this accelerating technological productivity at that time as well. So that's when you start to see great disruption to the lives of the workers, who are more than anything accustomed to what was called the domestic system of output, where you have a cottage industry. It's these weavers and cloth workers who made up the largest industrial base of England's workforce besides agricultural workers.
So this is so huge.
It's huge. Hundreds of thousands of people. And so when you have this relatively small subset of factory owners and aspiring factory owners start to use this machinery, it is a direct threat to that way of life. It's a direct and immediate economic threat because all of a sudden these little factories and proto factories and mini factories can work much more efficiently than one person at home. But they're also producing worse goods because usually what you do is you get some of these new machines that can speed up production, but then you need someone to run it, but you want to get somebody who's cheaper than a skilled artisan because otherwise that'd cut into your profits. So you get a child or a migrant worker or an unskilled laborer to come and work the machines. So you really have not what we think of as sort of displacement by automation. These jobs aren't disappearing; they're just being transferred from skilled workers to unskilled ones for the profit of the person who owns the machines. And then this makes a lot of people angry. People who've worked in this field for a long time see their wages calamitously decline, and then you see social unrest brewing. So that's what's happening among the workforce in England around the turn of the century there.
And people recognize what's happening. And I found it fascinating in your introduction, you write that even a couple of hundred years before this, people could see the danger of a machine. There was the creation, I think it was called a stocking frame, that they tried to get Queen Elizabeth, so this is like around 1600 or so, to give a license to, but she rejected it because she was like, something like this is going to upend normal society because it's going to put people either out of work or it's going to transform work.
Yeah, that was the stocking frame. That was the first, what you could argue is sort of the first machine that really kind of starts the slow roll of the Industrial Revolution. The potential of these machines to workers was immediately obvious. Same thing with the power loom when Edmund Cartwright sort of invents or sets out to try to invent the machine that will eventually mechanize the process of weaving, which for a long time, even in the early Industrial Revolution, was thought too complicated to do. He sets out to try to do it, and he sends it to Manchester, where there's a lot of cotton workers, and says, hey, sends it to some workers and say, hey, help me figure out how to do this. Like, you guys are the experts. I don't know how to do it. And they just said, no, we know what this means. If you fix this, if you get this thing to work, we don't want any part of that, because what you're going to do is you're going to use it to try to automate the process of weaving, and you're going to try to benefit from the machine at our expense.
The Luddites are named after a figure by the name of Ned Ludd. Ned Ludd, is he a fictional character?
Yeah, we can't say for sure. The record keeping is imperfect, and it's, as we'll probably talk about, this was a very secret society by necessity. So you can't say for sure, but it sure seems like it's apocryphal that this was a figure who was made up for the benefit of these organizers, because what happens as those conditions have worsened by around 1811 or so, they're not just bad, they're intolerable to a lot of people. There's a big crop failure, so the harvests aren't good. You have taxes that have been ratcheted up to pay for the war against Napoleon that the British government has been pursuing for years and years now, and it's everybody's tired of it, they're sick of it. And then there's a trade embargo that cuts off exports of cloth goods, so now the trade is falling. And then into this vacuum, those sort of early entrepreneurs use this opportunity to try to buy up more automated machinery, just as we might imagine them doing today. When there's trade is at a weakness, they use this as a point of leverage to try to capture more market share with their machinery, thus putting more and more skilled workers out of jobs. And finally, their backs are against the wall. In 1811, these workers, they rise up and they begin this campaign that's very organized, very strategic, very tactical, and very forceful, where they, threaten factory owners who have the machines that are taking their jobs, with a visit from Ned Ludd. And as you said, Ned Ludd is this apocryphal figure who, you know, saying it out loud next to Robin Hood, Ned Ludd, Robin Hood. This movement sort of begins in and around Nottingham, the stomping grounds of Robin Hood. So there's this rich tradition of dissent, and this folklore sort of heroic element.
Well, it's interesting, the connection between Robin Hood and Ned Ludd. Yeah, Nottingham, Sherwood Forest.
Yeah, it's by Sherwood Forest, and the legend goes that Ned Ludd was a young stocking frame knitter who was apprenticing, and his master thought that he wasn't working hard enough, so he brought him to the village magistrate, who had him whipped for not being productive enough. And Ned Ludd was a kid or a young man who was not inclined to take that well. So he picked up a hammer and he smashes his master's machine, and he flees into Sherwood Forest, where he starts to gather an army of like-minded men oppressed by the exploitative use of machinery. So this band of Ned Ludd's army become the Luddites, and they are not at the time mocked or scorned for being backwards looking, as the word might indicate today. They were fierce folk heroes as they go about this campaign, where somebody will send a threatening letter to a factory owner and say, if you don't take down your machines, you'll get a visit from Ned Ludd's army. And if they don't take them down, sure enough, under the cover of night, they will get a visit from men who are organized kind of like an army regiment or a platoon might be organized. They'll hold up the overseer at gunpoint, and they march into the factory with giant hammers, and they smash the offending machines. Just the machines that are automating the work that used to be done by men, that just the machines that are violating the social contract, just the machines that are sort of disrupting the way of life. The other machinery, the other implements, the other tools, they can stay. And if, as they leave, they tend to say something like, if you bring back the machines, you'll get another visit, and this time we'll do the whole place. So they get off with a warning. The machine is specifically, it is both actually, producing profits for the employer at their expense. So they're achieving a tactical end and smashing this thing, but it's also symbolic, right? These are the machines that are accelerating the imbalance between, the rich and the poor in England at the time. So by smashing this machine, they're sending this gesture. And that's the kind of thing that makes them so popular, along with their sort of daring. It's a time when the rich are getting richer, the poor are getting poorer, and to see somebody standing up for the working man is immensely popular. So Ned Ludd gets songs written about him, hymns and poems, and he gets embraced by the romantic poets, and it really becomes quite a popular movement, and it is based on this sort of fierce and strategic goal, which is to just dismantle the machinery that is, quote, hurtful to commonality. Not all machines. It's not unthinking. It's very strategic. It's very, very sort of well organized and well oiled, so to speak. So it's far from a knee jerk, reactionary dunderheadedness. They have selected their targets with care, and they're sending a message and about what you have, the way that they think machinery should be used in society. And people respond. It was very popular. It had to be stamped out by force by the state.
A lot there I want to unpack. We do have some people who were Luddites who we know were real people. Two names I'm going to ask you about that come up frequently in your book, George Mellor and Grosvenor Henson. Who were they?
George Mellor was the best known Luddite, who was definitely a Luddite, who led his band of they're called croppers, and they had a specific job, which was to sort of finish cloth. They would take these enormous shears. It was extremely difficult and extremely skilled work. So they'd take these enormous shears, and sort of once the cloth had already been produced by the machinery, it's usually produced with this coarse, it's not finished, it's still rough to the touch, and it's not suitable to be worn, say, as like a sweater or whatever. So they take these giant shears, and they, you can look at pictures of them. It's hard to do them justice because they weigh 50 pounds, and they sort of run the shears over the cloth to finish it off or to smooth it off. And they're called cloth finishers or croppers. They're some of the more sort of powerful cloth work. Their job is so important. If they do a good job, it makes a really nice garment. If they tank it, then the whole thing's ruined. So it's really important you have a good cropper. And there is a new machine that was going to start doing their job, the shearing frame. And so they organized into some of the fiercest bands of Luddites and took on some of the most daring actions. And his story is recorded in an oral history and also a novel that was sort of a historical novel based on real interviews. So we have a good sense of him, but he's done a duty, you know, done a tour of duty in the war against Napoleon. He has spent 7 years apprenticing as a cropper, and he gets to his job, and within just a couple of years, there are factory bosses trying to organize these machines to wipe out his trade in total. Again, that's the crucial part of the element. The community didn't agree to this. They didn't say, oh, this would be great if we had this and we could all sort of do this for cheaper. In this case, it really is a couple of guys from out of town setting up big factories outside town, trying to get a bunch of these mechanical implements, and then they just get to decide the new configuration of how technology is going to be used, because they have money, because they have power, because they have influence, and then they get to impose this new paradigm on the community. And to George and a lot of the other croppers, it feels like they're just stealing their work. They're stealing away their livelihood. It's not a democratic process. It's by force, and it looks like theft. They call it, they're stealing our bread. So George becomes, for better, you know, for our purposes, he becomes a General Ludd. He's the sort of local leader. There may have been others, but he's definitely one of them. And then he winds up leading the most famous failed Luddite raid on a huge factory called Rawfold's Mill that winds up a failure, and they get turned away in a hail of gunfire. A bunch of Luddites die, and that's one of the turning points in the Luddite struggle. So he's a real, you know, militant labor leader who's doing what, you know, the historian Eric Hobsham would call collective bargaining by riot. And he is actually out there with the hammers and leading folks to the factory doors under the cover of night. Gravener Henson, who you mentioned, again, not conclusive. We don't have but he was probably a Luddite too. He was probably out there with the hammer too, but he's more famous for being a sort of a reformer. While the Luddite activity swells up, and again, this is probably by design, we don't know for sure, but there are the Nottingham Luddites who are smashing a device called the wide frame that was mechanizing the production of knitted goods, like especially hose. And it was doing just a really lousy job of it. The wide frame would make two pieces of cloth that you then stitch together. And of course, they'd fall apart, where a skilled knitter would make hose, you know, in one consecutive tube all the way up. And it would last much longer. But the wide frames could churn out stuff for very cheap. And then all of a sudden that pushed down prices for the product in general. And now the knitters who were already suffering had to compete on price with that. And so it was a huge problem. And Gravener Henson starts, he's slightly unusual for some of the working men at the time. He's a good writer. He's literate, and he's also a very tactical mind in a different sense, where he starts agitating for reform, gathering petitions, trying to push for laws. Meanwhile, probably, well, that's by day, and then by night, he's probably out there helping to organize the Luddite campaigns around Nottingham, where they're actually smashing the machines as a means of putting pressure on legislators and reformers to pass laws. So Gravener takes that end. Really, really interesting guy. The great British historian E.P. Thompson has designated Gravener Henson as one of just three or four men who are most crucial to sort of the formation of the modern working class movement for doing a lot to sort of, you know, expand class consciousness through his writings, through his agitating, through his Luddite campaign. And what E.P. Thompson ultimately argues is that the Luddites are one of the cataclysmic events in getting sort of the working class to think of itself as a working class, to experience solidarity, to say, hey, we're all in this together. Because it wasn't just the cloth workers, it was also steel workers, coal workers, shoemakers, artisans of every stripe who recognized the general trends and the ways that the winds were blowing and the ways that machines were be using, even if they weren't getting used against them yet. They recognized the way that these forces were taking shape, and it was all in an effort to squeeze them, the artisan, the working guy. So they were out there with the Luddites raiding factories and marching in the streets as well. And that's something that puzzled authorities at the time. They'd say, hey, you're a steelworker. Why would you be out there in the streets? You're going to benefit from the Industrial Revolution. And the steelworker would say, not if it happens like this. Not if it happens where just a handful of guys at the top running their machines get to take the profits for themselves, and then we stay at the bottom and we stay squeezed, being forced into these working structures where we have to work for the man. You know, they understood. They weren't dumb, so they were fighting with the Luddites to try to prevent that formation from taking root.
This is Letters and Politics, and we are in conversation with Brian Merchant. Brian Merchant is the author of the book Blood in the Machine, The Origins of the Rebellion Against Big Tech. You can read his writings online at bloodinthemachine.com. Brian Merchant, tell me about this was a popular movement. These weren't just some cranks. Again, getting back to this modern day usage of the term Luddite, but what's also fascinating, it had big, prominent, well-known supporters, people like the Lord Byron, the poet, and I think he was also a member of Parliament, Percy Shelley, Mary Shelley, who wrote Frankenstein. And I think that's probably significant because I think Frankenstein's the first great modern book we have about technology.
They were quite popular at the time, as I mentioned, in the sort of the folkloric strain. Like, they did have people coming out in the streets. There's a while there where even certain officials would, you know, after it was they were successful doing by night, they sort of switched to just kind of, you know, doing their raids by day. And sometimes town officials would come out and just kind of watch and because they also thought that their actions were just. They were sort of cheered, you know, by crowds who would watch them taking part in these raids and smashing the machines again, because it was just so well understood the way that the machine was being used. It wasn't that they were just smashing machines that people didn't understand and smash them. No, it was understood what was happening and who was benefiting and who was profiting and at the expense of whom. So the state couldn't let that go on, so, or in its eyes anyways, right? So they started mobilizing troops. They started passing laws that made it a crime punishable by death to break machinery. They started to mount up, you know, the very authoritarian response. And in response to that, the young poet, Lord Byron, who was a lord, his Newstead Abbey, which was his estate, his family estate, was up right next to Nottingham, just north of Nottingham. And so he had seen this all firsthand. He saw the conditions of the working people and how much suffering they endured before they took to these extremes. And Byron had seen all that. So he was staunchly on the side of the cloth workers, and he, in fact, delivers his very first speech to the House of Lords all lords are expected to make speeches. He gives his very first speech in defense of the Luddites as they're trying to make it a crime punishable by death to break a machine. And he really lays into the state. He gives this thundering sort of well-written, very, maybe too well-written, because it's like very showy, and he's just kind of, you know, people, and you know, very few people actually take it seriously. He's so young, and he's already starting to become a literary celebrity, so, you know, it's very play-like, but it endures as the most famous speech in defense of the Luddites at the time. It was by far the most powerful pro-Luddite work, and he continues to publish poems in the newspapers, mostly anonymously. And so Mary Shelley is writing Frankenstein in 1815 or so, and you know, by then she's married to Percy Shelley, who is a huge Luddite supporter. She had grown up in London while this is all going on, her formative years. Her father is an intellectual, who one of the first anarchists, and he sort of inspires her as you know, to think about things in a different way. And
her mom's Mary Wollstonecraft.
Talk about those parents. And then she spends some time up with these radical egalitarians up in Scotland. So she has this really formative, and she just, you know, her writing early on, she's just amazing. She's just a very natural, evocative, and quite gifted, obviously, writer. And so she carries with her all these things, and she writes Frankenstein in the latter half of the 1810s and revises it just as the last Luddites are being hung. And it doesn't explicitly mention Luddism, of course, but it's all about a reckless man who builds technology for his own glorification and benefit and then turns his back on the results. So a lot of scholars have argued that it's, you know, among many, one of the primary metaphors she's drawing on is the use of technology and the Luddite revolt against it in that decade. And it does sort of stamp this very early critique of reckless use of powerful technologies that we may not fully understand. But the thing that gets lost in a lot of modern day translations of Frankenstein is that her monster was very intelligent, it was not just that he was created and then went on a rampage, and it's, you know, it's like, oh no, like, you know, Dr. Frankenstein did a bad thing and then he tampered with forces he didn't understand and then all hell broke loose. No, in the original Frankenstein, the monster is very intelligent, and all he wants is to be taken care of. He wants companionship. He wants his creator to try to level with him and to spend time with him, but his creator is just disgusted with him and time and again rejects him, spurns him, flees, you know, neglects him, and all, you know, to these entreaties. So that then the monster embarks on this campaign of vengeance to try to force him to take care of him, decided to either build him a companion so that he's not painfully alone, basically satisfy his social conditions. And Dr. Frankenstein refuses, you know, Victor Frankenstein, he like just abandons him. So it's much more of a fitting parable to what was happening with the Luddites and the working classes at the time.
You know? It's interesting to me how Frankenstein, both the word Frankenstein and Luddites changed in time.
Yeah.
Because you're right. When you think of Frankenstein, you think of a monster. But of course, Frankenstein was the name of the doctor.
Yeah.
And this creation was, as you said, this very sympathetic, you know, in many ways, very sympathetic creature, which you get if you read the book. But yeah, you don't get that necessarily in the movies, or, you know, we think of Frankenstein as the monster himself.
Yeah, you know, I think that it's interesting. So with the Luddites, the word, a lot of work had to be done to make sure that the Luddites were remembered in ignominy, right? It was the state who from day one started publishing these pamphlets, started putting out rewards, started describing the Luddites as these, you know, these backwards looking people who had fallen under the malign influence of some, you know, dark, you know, force, some leader. And they, it was this very, this kind of, they know not what they do. Otherwise they wouldn't be smashing the machines that are their job. Can't they see that if they smash the machines and they're going to have nothing to, they're going to have no machines to work. And it really, the predators, they used all these words that sort of indicated that they were sort of dumb barbarians and the unwashed masses kind of. And, you know, it was sort of kind of a even battle for a while. I mean, the state obviously has much more power, the pamphlets, the perches, the speeches that in they can, when they're declaring them, when the criminals in the halls of parliaments, you know, when they're passing these laws, they certainly have the highest stage. But as long as the Luddites, you know, had the sympathy of the masses, then there's these folk songs and things that are countervailing it. But eventually, you know, the Luddites just do get crushed. And it is important to remember that, you know, I think there's also some misconception that, like, well, the Luddites' argument lost. Like, well, the Luddites said, you know, we should have this mode where people are working in their homes, producing cloth with machinery in their homes, and that's just less efficient. The market eventually decided that it wants more efficient and much cheaper goods, and they're willing to tolerate, you know, a drop in quality. That's just what the market decided. That's not the case at all. You know, the state had to mobilize tens of thousands of troops. They had to forcibly put the Luddites down in a hail of gunfire. They had to, you know, they had to hang Luddites by the dozen, you know, in order to make an example of them. And then they had to sort of embark on this propaganda campaign that more or less, you know, continues to this day to sort of cast Luddites as dummies.
So that wasn't by chance that this term, right, Luddite changes over time.
Yeah, no, not by chance. A very repetition from, you know, you could call it propaganda, right? From the state has to repeat it over and over, and has to sort of, even at the famous Luddites trial, when the Luddites who participated in that attack against Rawfold's Mill and others are being tried, you know, this is the language that they're using, as like these backwards, poor wretches, the misunderstanding, like they know not what they do, and they're sort of minting this very sort of this mischaracterization as the one that's going to endure. And of course the state wins that case, so you could argue it really sort of crystallizes there as they're hanging these men. They're the losers. They tried to change the course of history. They tried to smash what they didn't like, and they lost. Look what happens when you go against technology. You lose. You get punished. You're dumb, and you're just consigned to the dustbin of history this way.
Brian Merchant has been our guest. He has joined us to talk about the history of the Luddites. Brian Merchant is the author of the book Blood in the Machine: The Origins of the Rebellion Against Big Tech. You can also read his writings online at bloodinthemachine.com. Brian Merchant, that was fascinating. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. This was great.
And you're listening to Letters and Politics on listener sponsored KPFK in Los Angeles. I have a bit to say, and I'll say it in a moment, but first, it is imperative that we try to raise some money today. We are behind, and I want to give you the phone number and let you know how you can make that contribution. Of course, I do ask for that contribution that you can afford, that's according to your means, and that you feel good about knowing that you did your part. The phone number, we ask, you know, it could be $25, $50, $75. If you are interested in a thank you gift, all the thank you gifts that we've offered in this drive are available. Also available is the book that we were in conversation about today called Blood in the Machine: The Origins of the Rebellion Against Big Tech. It is a history of the Luddites that is available for a contribution of $150. The phone number is 818-985-5735, 818-985-5735. and online at kpfk.org. Today's show is another one of these kind of programs that I like doing most here, because we have this expectation of putting a program on every day. Sometimes it's hard every day to have this kind of a program on each day, though most of the time we try. And sometimes what's happening in the world compels us to respond to the breaking news of the time. Sometimes we do that well. It is my background as a journalist. But honestly, a part of me over the years grew tired as I got older, probably not a coincidence, of just chasing the very latest story as it's happening, because I began to feel it's ephemeral, really. And that you really can't get closer to the truth, if you can ever get to the truth at all, which I'm dubious about. But it's hard to even get closer to the truth until some time has passed, till you let some things settle. And as a reporter, I felt as though I was always talking about something that just happened just to talk about it, because that's what everyone else is talking about, and we just need to talk. And it's difficult for me to be so cynical about talking because, well, that's what I do for a living. And I try to get others to talk. And I felt like after time, all I was doing was talking to talk. All I was covering was talking points that I already knew, but just needed people's voices to say them. Now, don't get me wrong. Covering the news as it happens is wildly important. It's more important than what I do here. But there are a lot of people already doing it. And usually the plethora of voices that are out there already doing it, I don't have much to add, because oftentimes I'm not even in the place where it's happening. I mean, the most important media work are the people that are in war zones or places of tragedy and natural disaster, bringing those stories to light so that the world can know them, so that the world hopefully, though oftentimes not, can respond and try to, you know, alleviate some of the misery out there. That's the most, 10 billion times more important than what I do. But I'm not in a place really to do that, and I'm just not in a place anymore in life where I just want to talk. To be topical. I don't get paid enough to just fake it. Now, if I were paid maybe six figures to do that, I would probably do it. But I'm not. Honestly, I get paid just enough to barely make it by in a rent-controlled apartment in the Bay Area. And so with that, I'm not complaining. I'm just saying, with that, well, I'm just going to be me. And I feel like our contribution with this radio program, Letters and Politics, then, in that spirit, is to take a step back. We're still talking. But try to talk about these really big societal forces and see how they have affected people over time, to better understand how these very similar, if not same, forces affect us today. It's not meant to be some Rosetta Stone to explain what we are living through today, but it is meant, I hope, if it means anything at all, to put us in time, to feel that we are part of a larger continuum that existed before us and that will exist after us. It's not the most important work in media, but I do hope you feel it's worth still having around and worth supporting here on our final day of this fund drive, as we ask you for a financial contribution that you can afford to help keep us on the air. As I speak to you right now, I think, where was I put the number? I think we're $111,000 as a radio station away from reaching our goal. But this is the lifeblood of public broadcasting. And it is vital for me to come to you to ask you for your support, because this isn't a program that is about trying to get the ratings. I know how to do that. I've done it before. I felt it was unfeeling. And I don't get paid enough, you know. And so I'm asking you to support this program with a contribution here and help us get as close as we can to that goal by the end of tomorrow. Because we will do more. We will do more to make. We're going to do more. I'm not even going to lie to you. If we can get, no, it doesn't matter how far away from the goal we get. We will do whatever it takes to keep this radio station operating. But we do need your help to make that happen. 818-985-5735. 818-985-5735. And online at kpfk.org. I felt today, I'm joining you from Oakland, it's gloomy outside, both metaphorically and weather-wise. It was appropriate to talk about how technology, how capitalism, how these big societal forces upends people's livelihoods. And what's happening now is about capitalism and corporations leaving for greener pastures and leaving behind the community that sustained it for so long. So in that way, it is kind of like deindustrialization. Now, I'm an outlier on this, but I want to say this. I'm probably going to ruin my fundraising efforts here, spending too much time on something else. But I love the Oakland Alameda County Coliseum. And that's its real name, the Oakland Alameda County Coliseum. Not some corporate name from some different company every year that puts up a bunch of money to change the name, and that's now what we have to call it, like in San Francisco. It's a shame that the ballpark that the Giants play at doesn't actually have its own name. It's not like you could say Candlestick and everyone knows what you're talking about. I'm always struggling to try to come up with the new corporate name of wherever the Giants play. But regardless of what corporation, and they are sponsoring the Oakland Alameda County Coliseum this year, we all know it as the Coliseum. If you grew up here, you grow up with the Coliseum in your life. My first concert ever was at the Coliseum. I went to many, many events at the Coliseum over the years. And I always like to say, the Romans had their Colosseum, and we have ours. And yeah, I know what some of you are thinking. It's a dump. It is. But it's our dump. And I am definitely an outlier on this, but I like historic structures. I like ruins. And the reality is the Colosseum is really the last of its kind. But I thought it was appropriate. I felt in my soul a connection to the Luddites in this. 818-985-5735. 818-985-5735. And online at kpfk.org. All of our thank you gifts are available. You can go to the website, check out the things that we've offered over this fund drive. If you appreciate the approach we take with this fund drive, a show about the Luddites, a show about native indigenous civilizations within the continental United States that existed hundreds of years before Europeans even arrived here, and how they were formed and why people left them to create a more egalitarian life. Really fascinating. We did a show about the history of fall of civilizations with Paul Cooper. You know, Paul Cooper, if you like watching documentaries on YouTube, he does the documentary Fall of Civilizations. We had him on. If you think of the many different programs that we have done, if you appreciate our approach to fundraising, oftentimes I do hear people saying, Well, Mitch, and you know, believe me, some people say they don't like it either. But I do get notes from people saying, I appreciate the way you try to raise funds and the spirit you put into it. And I appreciate that. But it's not always effective. It doesn't always seem to work for me. Now, this is the life of a public broadcaster. I don't want to stir you into a frenzy to donate, and I don't want to give you a false assumption that this show saved the world or make the world, but I don't think that's true. What I do think that is true is that it is a show that to me has always been about educating and
Due to years of deferred maintenance at KPFK's transmitter site, it has become imperative to repair critical components to continue broadcasting at full power. Now we have an exciting opportunity to ensure the full power signal of KPFK, allowing us to continue to reach all our listeners, improve our broadcast quality, and connect with all the communities that need our message. However, we can't do it without you. Please support the Transmitter Repair Fund in our December Fund Drive by calling 818-985-5735, press option 2, or pledge online anytime at kpfk.org and click the red transmitter on the front page of the website. Any additional funds raised for this project will support our daily operations, including resuming regular maintenance at the transmitter site. Thanks for donating to People Powered KPFK, and happy holidays to all.
Those of us who work in community radio have always understood the power of passionate and committed individuals.
And that's what this time, Fund Drive Time at KPFK, is all about.
If you're passionate about the current affairs and cultural programming that KPFK brings to you every day, come rain or come shine,
then please commit yourself to our future.
Pledge your support to KPFK securely online at kpfk.org/donate.
Or give us a call at 818-985-5735.
That's 818-985-KPFK.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! In-depth news coverage is becoming a rare commodity in today's media landscape. There's a straightforward reason. It's no longer profitable for commercial media. Serious journalism is expensive. It takes time to prepare. It requires a large and talented team of researchers, reporters, editors, and producers. That's why listener-supported news and information on KPFK is more important than ever. We continue to bring you comprehensive coverage from skilled, dedicated journalists because you continue to support the work we do here all year round. Please continue to support KPFK, all the vital work that's done at this Pacifica station. Call 818-985-5735. That's 818-985-KPFK and join the KPFK Sustainer Circle, or you can give at kpfk.org.
Hello, I'm Armistead Maupin, author of Tales of the City. IMRU Radio Magazine has been the voice of the LGBT community in Southern California since 1974. And you can listen every Monday night from 7 to 8 p.m. right here on KPFK.
The first time I heard KPFK, it was in the wee hours, maybe 2 a.m., Roy of Hollywood was on, right? And he was playing Alan Watts. And it was so surreal. I was